Okay, so independent media practitioners end up spending a whole lot of time thinking through and creating videos that are exploring questions of power, persuasion, and movement building. Sifting through activist documentaries, both the formal and the conceptual problems facing alternative media becomes really quickly apparent. Created with limited resources and limited training, movies' technical and structural flaws frequently end up actually undermining the power of story. As activist media makers, this is something I've kind of learned at Free Speech TV, which is that our audience thinks that we are like the competitors of Fox News. And so I had this startling realization in the last few weeks, actually, that like the independent media network, right, and all the kind of independent media networks are the tool that we have to fight the corporate media giants with, right? So it's like us versus Fox News, which puts us in a crisis of production. So in order to turn our democratic alternative media networks into viable rivals of multinational media empires, we have to use the free tools of aesthetics and structure to win in the war of ideas against the propagandists of the state, corporate and cultural tyranny. So these observations are sketches of ideas in process, and I hope that they raise some important questions as we kind of determine how best to use anarchist media for movement building. Through programming, through writing, discussion, spectatorship, and production, we're working on what questions need to be asked, what strategies need to be used, what methodologies work best in order to build viable movements. And because these are broad, I really want to have a kind of strong conversation afterwards about the problematics of all this stuff. So through the last century, anarchist producers have greatly used avant-garde and DIY tactics to attack culture. From like independent media journalists, right, to abstract expressionist painters, anarchists have been involved in stylistic innovation and democratic grassroots storytelling. The contributions of iconoclastic elite aesthetics, gestural camera work, aggressive punk, and explorations of the non-rational have ended up paving the way for DIY video production, for sloppy camera work, for poorly lit images and an incoherent narrative. Our elitist arts have possibly trained us to tolerate visual and sonic decay in our activist journalism. And at this point, our democratic media frequently borders on becoming what I'd like to term an accidental postmodern theater of cruelty. Right, so we're suffering through a lot of this work as we watch it. It doesn't give us pleasure. Anarchist artists have used a wide variety of aesthetics to critique culture and reinvent the world according to their desires. And many of the most important contributions regarding this involve aggressive and at times alienating aesthetics. In The Theater and Its Double, Antonin Artaud proposes that theater and subsequently art should replace political violence with cultural terrorism. The Situationists intervened in all sorts of ways in the psychogeography of daily life, challenging quotidian structures with symbolic, graphic intervention and appropriation. And you guys just presented some amazing work that kind of follows in the same suit, similarly. Musicians as varied in form as like Crass and John Cage have aggressively pushed the limits of music and performance, confronting audiences with chaotic noise and sometimes also chaotic silence. I think of filmmakers like Jeannie Liotta and Peter Hutton, who are kind of landscape filmmakers taking a rearguard approach, creating hypnagogic, meditative landscape films designed to invoke the space between the conscious and the unconscious. Right? Hypnagogic meaning that beautiful space between being awake and asleep, right? But clearly a space of incoherence. The Yes Men have used media to playfully prank the think tanks of global capitalism, while artists like Rafael Montañez-Ortiz, Craig Baldwin, Martin Arnold have turned recycled found footage into cultural critique. Now, all of these approaches are vital to expanding culture and abolishing capitalism and domination. Yet, as these artists challenge older forms of elitism, they create new elitist models, new symbolic orders, and new barriers to emergent culture. In response to a lot of these individualist modes of production, certain aesthetic strategies adopted by anarchists emphasize participatory creation and erode the border between the spectator and the artist. The theaters of Grotowski, of Augusto Boal, exemplify inclusive, collective, and non-hierarchical practice where participants create theatrical experiences collaboratively, generating performance as a group. Community television initiatives and open source websites like Indie Media provide any member of the community who has access to certain technologies the ability to report on current events. In these forms, at best, the audience is integral to the experience because they determine it by being it. At worst, these forms tend to breed cultural carelessness and attempt to disguise expertise behind a cultivated aesthetic sloppiness, which is a feigned possible signature of egalitarianism and democracy. In other words, there's a way that people who are skilled and trained degrade their own aesthetics in order to look more egalitarian, right? Without a serious self-imposed editorial mechanism, so an editorial mechanism we decide upon ourselves, these forms can become really good excuses for mediocre productions by creators who have neglected to take responsibility for the quality of their work. Anarchist media can empower collective creativity, but can also excuse the tyranny of the amateur, compromising the quality of product for a meaningful process. Right. At this particular historical moment, the right is clearly dominating capitalist and alternative media. In the marketplace of ideas, or their marketplace of ideas, they're winning. Using binary classical modes of thinking, defining clear protagonists and antagonists, and relying on what Leo Strauss, one of their favorite philosophers, calls noble myths to lead the people towards destruction, the right has prevailed against anti-authoritarians, intent on thinking in terms of multiplicity, rhizomes, and what the right has correctly termed relativity. Many of the right's most successful tactics come from their commitment to classical modes of thought, challenged by post-structuralists obsessed with decoding essentialisms. Through rigorous dialectics and binary linear narratives, the right has tactically overwhelmed the diversity of movements hell-bent on ruminating over things like schizoanalysis, experimentation, and deconstruction. Essentially, the right has used classical narrative modes to attack the good intentions and really interesting philosophical pursuits of the rest of us. Their tactics are decidedly Machiavellian and not grounded in a philosophical quest for the real. While it can be destructive to prioritize ends over means, surrendering some, or at least considering surrendering some of our innovative tendencies, complicated mappings, rougher aesthetics, and reconsidering classical narrative strategies may be our only hope in countering the cultural work of the right. In order to demonstrate this point, I'm going to present an example of an anarchist protest video, a hypothetical anarchist protest video, grounded largely in a whole lot of different kind of anti-racist, anti-fascist anarchist protest videos. So I'll describe it, give you an idea of what I'm talking about, and we'll go from there. Okay. So imagine a television screen, right? On the television screen, you see a pack of black-clad punks screaming, "Racist, go home, racist, go home, racist, go home." The distorted audio, which yours is probably right now because I overproject, at any rate, the distorted audio is roaring, peaking, pushing the microphone to the limit and beyond. Every time the cameraman joins in the chanting, the audio actually drops out altogether. The images fluctuate between blown-out clipped whites, figures lost, invisible, overexposed, to crushed blacks, you know, grainy, gritty chaos, occasional lights, occasional shapes, images underexposed. When faces and voices are actually clear enough to understand, we hear cursing threats, idiotic jokes, and anti-fascists slipping into sexist, homophobic language. "You fucking pussy, you racist faggot." You guys are familiar with this soundtrack, I'm sure. We hear racists then follow, you know, mocking anti-fascist hypocrisy. We watch young men, young anarchist men, beating another man, calling him a fascist, violent fuck. Watching the footage, having the privilege to fast forward, slow down, study, pause, rewind, and play, the performance of activists can be scrutinized. This is frequently the burden of the editor of the video, who witnesses the wild looks in the eyes of the angry activists, the wandering, distracted posture of the distracted and bored, the tense communications between protesters, the ridiculous comments made to police, and the patronizing attempts by bystanders, I mean, the patronizing attempts to get bystanders to join in. Sometimes the editors do see glimpses of true conviction, of clarity, credibility, and gestures of kindness, dignity, and intelligence. At other points, the editors are cringing at filthy mouths, mad rants, humorless, unfunny jokes, gestures of violence and incoherence. The editors are also studying the banners, right? The legibility of the banners, their humor, their possible ragtag nostalgic sensibility, the way they're held, right? I mean, can you actually see what's going on these banners? The length, density, color, design of hair, makeup, and clothes, the quality of the movement on the set or the streets, all these things are scrutinized by the obsessive editor, given this privilege of looking at the same thing over and over and over again. The unsteady image, the crushed blacks, the clipped whites, the peaking sound, all these things are actually deemed illegal for broadcast, right? Meaning you can't broadcast them because they actually interfere with the quality of the signal. The editor, slightly disheartened and slightly amused, ends up cutting unsalvageable footage together into a rambling, somewhat linear collection of unrelated images from the action. The result is messy, unstructured, and boring to all but the narcissistic activists fascinated by their own heroism. Once the piece has been produced, the amiable viewers trying to grasp the state of the world end up turning away from the activist media, unaccustomed to watching a bad signal, an unrecognizable image, and suffering through unbalanced, distorted sound. The madness of it all, the poorly expressed ideology, the performative similarities between the fascists and the anti-fascists, the nausea-inducing handheld camera work incapable of proper exposure, and the utter disregard of narrative arc, in other words, beginning, middle, and end, accidentally alienates the viewer. Rather than wading through the unwatchable incoherence, they turn to capitalist media, where well-lit patriarchs engage in aggressive banter on screen while destroying the world off screen. A chance to mobilize the viewer has been sacrificed by aesthetic carelessness. Now, in the interest of an inflated self-esteem, we can pat ourselves on the back and attribute our performative inadequacies to individuality, originality, and revolutionary tendencies, or we can encounter the disturbing truth. We were in the streets performing for everybody else, and we looked really bad. In short, we failed to act like protagonists. We failed to act our story well, and even if we had, we would have failed to shoot it well. The sad truth is that if we don't directly correct our inadequate performance and learn to document a good story, we will look like the antagonists and lose in the marketplace of ideas. So the aforementioned scenario is a grim hypothetical based strongly in several years of watching, programming, and producing this type of activist media. It's a generalization based on an amalgamation of confrontational videos produced in good faith with little means. It exemplifies a genre of alternative media production in its most glorious and faulty aspects. At best, it will not be seen and therefore will not be harmful. If seen, it could actually injure our ability to build movements. Residing on both sides of the divide as a programmer and a producer, I have the privilege of understanding the urgency, exhaustion, and self-confidence of the battle-weary video makers. Sifting through hours of bad anarchist media and waiting for a video that will be as good as right-wing television, I wonder what all those people in the streets with cameras are actually doing. When I think back to my own experiences shooting at anti-fascist rallies, at protests against the free trade of the area of the Americas, et cetera, we feel like heroes in the streets telling an untold story. When we return from the action, we frequently share our stories with each other as we're editing the video footage. What we don't seem to do is tell the story on tape. Rather, we end up cutting together a violent montage of protest porn scored by the latest iconic anarcho-punk band, or we put the footage into the closet, or the footage goes to a legal team and is never edited, or it is lost in a collective editing process. Regardless, we find ourselves in a crisis of representation because there's an apparent crisis of production. Rarely have we as video activists taken the time to become skilled editors and shooters. Nor have we worried about accumulating all of the ingredients for a delicious cinematic recipe. Nor do we care about story, nor aesthetics, nor broadcast standards, nor mise-en-scene, cinematography, or sound. And as a result, it doesn't appear that we care too much about the audience either. Too much activist media is thoughtlessly created in a rush, and too many stories go untold because they are incompetently told without intentional structure, character development, and style. Now, the most compelling arguments for these rougher aesthetics suggest that within them lies a signature of the movement, a do-it-yourself sensibility, a self-reflexive, low-fidelity antidote to corporate finesse. When such arguments embrace bad, unintentionally alienating media, they are preposterous. When they defend well-structured narrative strategies, they pave the way for our signature DIY aesthetics to be taken seriously and improved upon. Our handheld style has already been adapted by mainstream media. Shows like Cops and Cheaters use this aesthetic to enforce the status quo by promoting policing, surveillance culture, and marital fidelity. Are you familiar with Cops and Cheaters? Really quickly. Okay, Cops is a show where they're like handheld cameramen who follow cops around, right? And watch the cops do all the sort of nasty things that cops do. Cheaters is a show where Joey Greco, the host, invites a lover to follow the beloved, or you have spies follow the beloved around as the beloved cheats on the lover, right?
Is it staged?
Yeah, it's no. Well known in New York, the Cheaters is staged because everybody. I know someone who's been on. They've been on Cheaters and they're not.
Wow, sure. That's scandalous! Amazing.
That's so real.
But they follow. Basically, they like follow these. They follow the affair around, and then they have the lover confront the beloved and the person the beloved's cheating with, and it's this big, violent, nasty confrontation. At any rate,
how utterly entertaining!
Yeah. So shows like Cops and Cheaters use this aesthetic to enforce the status quo. The corporate handheld aesthetic is commercially superior to its anarchist counterpart, neither because its subject matter is more interesting and relevant, nor because the image is stronger, but because it applies classical narrative strategies the audiences can follow and enjoy. The anarchist tendency to valorize spontaneity and shun narrative has an historical precedent in the anti-rational romantic traditions that influence anarchist-dominated art movements like surrealism and abstract expressionism. These traditions honor the importance of individual creative expression and resist character-driven linear narrative. While there is no denying the cultural and intellectual importance of these quests, they have de-emphasized clarity and reason for chaotic emotionalism and incoherence. For John Zerzan and others who see the symbolic order and representation as the root of oppression, the artistic move away from the symbolic and representational pushes us away from the horrors of civilization towards a feral telos best exemplified artistically in the paintings of the abstract expressionists. A feral telos, a wild end, right? A wild sort of utopian end. The only problem with this pure art theory is that it ignores that abstract expressionist aesthetics have become a dominant motif in capitalist marketing, and that the CIA even promoted the abstract expressionists to the rest of the world as evidence of American tolerance and freedom, thus using a pure, idealist anarchist project to promote American empire building. Idealist politics that reject language fail to be persuasive because they ignore the indestructibility of the symbolic, and fail to use systems of rhetoric and mimesis or representation to illustrate their point. While their abstract virtue is undeniable, their pragmatic application fails. One cannot confront a master narrative without telling a better story. Much like capitalist advertising has secured a place for abstract aesthetics by situating them within a larger rhetorical strategy, corporate media has used handheld aesthetics to aid its classical narrative tradition by supplementing the older form with an immediate and truthful visual style. As critics of corporate media reveal that the industry is serving the wealthy through mind-numbing journalism and brainwashing the collective psyche by successfully marketing products that kill, the producers use alternative, handheld, and DIY aesthetics to forge sincerity and develop an intimate relationship between the channel and the viewer. What they never shun in their product, the anarchist producers rarely use, again, is classical narrative strategy. So again, Leo Strauss, who's like the favorite philosopher of the neoconservatives, suggests that we look back to the classical texts of Western civilization and open our mind to our predecessors' immortal wisdom. Right? We're all familiar with this kind of nasty Western, conservatism. At any rate, realizing that ignoring the strategies of conservatives is tactical hogwash at this point, let's take a moment to leap back through Western literary criticism and delve into Aristotle's systematic notes on poetry, where we can immerse ourselves in a nearly quantitative classical notion of tragedy, a formulaic, highly rational approach to art. Aristotle in his Poetics prioritizes the components of tragedy into a useful hierarchy of importance that can help us understand why a show like Cheaters is more successful than our own activist endeavors. For Aristotle, the soul of tragedy is plot structure, the organization of events into a beginning, middle, and end, containing moments of recognition, reversal, and suffering. He defines plot as unity of action that involves a complication, that's everything that occurs from the beginning to the moment before a transformation towards prosperity or affliction, and a denouement, the section from the start of the transformation to the end of the piece. The second most important aspect of tragedy for Aristotle is characterization. Characters must be better than us, worse than us, clearly better than us, worse than us, or the same as us, and must generally undergo a clear rise or a clear fall. For Aristotle, characters must be ethically good, appropriate, consistent in behavior, and resemble the individual represented. Only the third most important aspect of tragedy is the capacity to produce pertinent and appropriate arguments. So it goes plot structure, characters, and only then arguments. According to Aristotle, in successful tragedy, the ideas are less important than the structure and the characters. The fourth most important element of style, the fourth most important element is style of expression, followed by lyrical poetry, and then spectacle. Cheaters follows this model precisely. Every show is narrated by a host who presents the same predictable pattern every time. During the first act, a lover suspects the beloved of cheating. During the second act, cheater spies follow on the beloved and use video to prove the accusations. During the loudly announced confrontation, the host and the lover confront the beloved. The conclusion and denouement occur when the lover describes reconciling or permanently ending the relationship, the rise or the fall. When you sit down to watch Cheaters, you expect this pattern, this structure. No irrelevant material is shown. There is an Aristotelian unity of plot, a clear beginning, middle, and end, moments of recognition when the lover realizes the accusations are true, and reversal, when the beloved frequently accuses the lover of doing nasty things. The characters are well-defined as victims and cheaters, protagonists and antagonists. We follow the rise and fall of both characters. The host is the voice of reason, clearly explaining the plot. The producers strategically communicate the show's arguments against infidelity because it is not aesthetically prioritized, that is, the argument is not as aesthetically prioritized as highly as plot structure and character development. The handheld camera work, the coercive music, and the spectacle of violence and seduction all contribute to the whole, but are insignificant compared to the plot. Without the structure and polarized characters, the rest would be boring. In our hypothetical, all-too-familiar DIY video, anarchist media has the tendency to reverse Aristotle's formula. It prioritizes the spectacle of violent protest porn first, the articulation of ideas and arguments found in the chaotic chants second. The third most important component is frequently lyrical poetry, the emotive garnishing, or the standard anarcho-punk score. Style fourth, that is the handheld camera work and rapid cuts. Character fifth, represented by the failed attempts to turn the anarchists into the protagonists and the fascists into the antagonists. Structure of utmost importance to Aristotle is prioritized last. It is no wonder that Cheaters appeals to more people than our own valiant activist media. We have neglected the classics. Capitalist media uses Aristotle well. Failing amateur media makers, we need to study the crafts that the other side is using. Bakunin writes, "In general, we ask nothing better than to see men endowed with great knowledge, great experience, great minds, and above all, great hearts, exercise over us a natural and legitimate influence, freely accepted and never imposed in the name of any official authority whatsoever, celestial or terrestrial." Do Leo Strauss and Michael Bakunin agree on the seemingly obvious point that people should learn from great minds? Could it be that corporate media follows this classical anarchist advice more than anarchist media makers, all too quick to dismiss the wisdom of antiquity? In our desire to liberate ourselves from the oppressive structures of Western civilization and tradition, have we rejected some of the best tools available? And also some of the freest tools available, character and plot structure. By structuring their invasions of privacy, their destruction of individual lives and relationships, their jealousy baiting, surveillance culture, and self-righteousness into formulas of Aristotelian poetics, the corporate scallywags that produce cheaters and who are championing capitalist monogamy have triumphed over anarchist media makers. Sadly, virtue and victory are not synonymous. Fortunately, our refusal to learn from the classics is not predetermined, and we are free to accept the tools of antiquity alongside those provided by other cultures and other times. Marxist dramatists Bertolt Brecht and Augusto Boal have contributed excellent critiques of Aristotelian poetics, attacking Aristotle's notion of catharsis and even the division between the drama and the spectator. Regardless of whether we buy into Aristotle's notions of catharsis, his formulas of tragedy, and observations regarding the role of poetry in affirming or judging our behavior, the most valuable strategy that anarchist media practitioners can borrow from the poetics is Aristotle's hierarchy of aesthetic priorities. First valuing structure, followed by character, and only then ideology, style, lyrical poetry, and spectacle. If a work is structurally unsustainable, does not define character specifically, it will not communicate an idea to the best of its ability because it will not hold the attention of the viewer. Many plot structures and models of characterization can potentially excite an audience. The anarchist media practitioner's job is to determine which of those can activate an audience to revolt and create. A healthy suspicion of singular models of articulation and a practice of experimentation can facilitate a diversity of entertaining and provocative structures for communicating anarchist visions. For this reason, anarchist media, varied as it should be, must not subscribe to the notion of a singular anarchist aesthetic, where all of our media production looks alike. While the DIY indie media aesthetic signature still has great potential, a diversity of aesthetic tactics will appeal to a broader range of viewers. At this stage of movement building, via media, the most important criteria when adopting an aesthetic is to have it be intentional. An intentional aesthetic targets a specific audience and uses form to affect the audience in a specific way, right? So you want to find who the audience is, right, and affect them in a specific way. It adopts and adapts the wisdom of both antiquity and modernity to create effective, moving, and carefully designed structures, character relationships, arguments, style, and spectacle. How we negotiate dualisms, classicism, rationalism, and structure will not only determine how we build our movement in opposition to tyranny, but how we create situations we want to live in. Intentional communities determine structures and models of domestic life with care, ideals, and ethics. In the same way, intentional media can be created that will not only entertain and compete with capitalist media, but that can model alternative ways of being and becoming. We should introduce our intentional media into competitive markets where it can challenge hegemony, right? So indie media should, in fact, be competing with Fox, as that's the playing field that we're in. Our tenuous struggle is to create viable alternatives that are more appealing than corporate fodder, while not resigning ourselves to structures and models that reinforce ideologies of domination. The most important developments regarding these questions of intentional aesthetics, of course, occur when we create and distribute media. As we do so, we have many questions to ask ourselves during production. What conceptual structures can we build that will be both entertaining and activating? Should we standardize successful structures and create formulas that can ease the burden of production, generate expectations that can be fulfilled, and facilitate the implementation of intentional aesthetics? Should we recreate original structures for each new effort in a constant state of experimental negotiation? How much should we emphasize experimentation as an idea? Can we develop an aesthetic that the corporate media cannot steal? Should we borrow the plot structures and binary character models of capitalist and state media? What's the role of the protagonist and the antagonist in anarchist media? How should we define them? How should we perform them? What role does resolution and catharsis play in our productions and interactions? Do we want audiences to identify with the struggle and feel like a part of the movement? Or do we want to provoke questions, provoke questioning processes that activate viewers to build new movements?